Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Today, I'm joined at the roundtable by Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the State House News Bureau. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday.
Natalie Fahmy, State House reporter for NBC4.
Glad to be here.
And Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Intel is finally getting paid what it was promised under the CHIPS Act. Well, most of it. The Biden administration is releasing $7.86 billion, and $1 billion of that will go to Intel before the end of the year. That's less than was initially promised. Why are we reducing the payout just by a little bit?
To my understanding, it has to do with other government contracts that they have, that slightly lower amount. And I know there were a lot of questions about why this money was so delayed. But when you see that lower final dollar amount, I wonder if some of it had to do with Intel trying to push for that higher amount that they wanted, because they have staked. I mean, you know, they've said they can fund this project, but you've seen them really struggle financially. And I think it's fair to say they're really relying on these federal and state dollars to get the project in New Albany done. And of course, the federal CHIPS money is not just going to the project in New Albany. It's also going to their projects in other states.
Yeah. Arizona, New Mexico, Oregon. And, you know, one of the other reasons I saw that I thought was interesting was some of the delays. So, like, the plant here in Ohio was supposed to be operational in 2025. That is not happening. They're now saying 2030. And I guess some of those deadlines are now going past the CHIPS Act deadlines.
Yeah, and despite the delays, Governor Mike DeWine says over and over again, we are going to get things done. Jobs are going to be created in the state. He kind of champions this still as a really great thing that's happening, even if they are slightly behind schedule.
And it is important that that 2030 date is interesting because I believe the state has contracts with Intel, of course, because the state sent its money to Intel a while ago. They've dispersed all of that money, and Intel has to fulfill certain job creation requirements by, I believe, 2028. So, you know, when I talked to an Intel spokesperson more than a year ago, they said 2025 was kind of a lofty goal. You know, it was hopeful, but not realistic. Once you're getting past 2027, 2028, they would be starting to not fulfill some of the, you know, obligations that they have to the state, at least with my understanding of the contract.
Yeah. Earlier this year, actually in mid-November, the Ohio Chamber of Commerce and 20 business groups from four states actually wrote a letter to the Biden administration, Megan, and they were like, hand the money out now. Do it now.
Yes. I mean, there has been quite this delay. It is interesting timing that now the money is released after this push. And too, I think another interesting facet of the Intel in Ohio is the education side of it here locally in Central Ohio with both K-12 schools and higher ed. And there's been lots of programs that Ohio State and Columbus State and other universities and colleges are doing to prepare students to do these jobs one day. And now now that it's pushed back, there's on one side, it gives them more time to have these programs and more students to be equipped and trained. But then those students with education might get jobs elsewhere and might not want to stick around and wait.
The other piece of timing that should be noted is the change in administrations. Of course, Joe Biden is leaving office. Donald Trump is about to take office. And President-elect Trump has been critical of the CHIPS Act, as have some of his surrogates. Now, of course, Senator-elect Bernie Moreno says that, you know, the government should honor its commitments to Intel. But it is interesting timing that suddenly this money gets dispersed right before Biden leaves office. Of course, you know, you've got situations where he's pardoning his son as well right before he leaves office. It's that lame duck kind of action that you see taken.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Ohio's lame duck in just a minute. But news broke over the weekend that the chief financial officer of Intel will now be the new CEO. Because Intel CEO Pat Gelsinger retired abruptly as of yesterday. This comes as the company continues to struggle. Last quarter, Intel reported its largest loss in the company's history, and it's been cutting costs, trying to fend off takeovers from rivals. So, yeah, the money, the retirement of the CEO, it's a very unsettling picture for those who invested so much in this Central Ohio project, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, I think Intel's financials have not been super rosy for a while now. It's kind of following the writing on the walls. So, I mean, especially the last two quarters have just been really, really ugly. And I know there was kind of this meme going around on Twitter that I think it was last quarter or maybe the quarter before that Pat Gelsinger was like praying on Twitter, and they were like, is it good if the CEO of Intel is putting prayers out on Twitter? So, I mean, I'm sure it's not terribly unexpected.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about lame duck in just a moment. But before state lawmakers left for their holiday break, Governor Mike DeWine signed a controversial bill into law. Megan, can you refresh us on what the bathroom bill requires of schools and colleges?
Yeah, so the bathroom bill, it impacts both Ohio schools in the K-12 front and also universities as well. And basically it just would ban a student, or it would require a student to use the bathroom or the locker room that matches with their sex assigned at birth. So that's basically the gist of the bill. And also on the K-12 side, it would ban students from sharing overnight accommodations, like on a school trip, for example, from them from rooming with someone of the opposite sex as well. So this would, of course, impact transgender students, but also not just the students, but also it calls into question, too, about visitors and perhaps teachers and employees who are transgender as well, and which bathrooms they're going to use.
So this law will go into effect in about 90 days?
Yes. The end of February.
But, Natalie, chances are there might be a lawsuit to block its implementation.
I would be shocked if there was not a lawsuit. We see that a lot with some of the more controversial bills coming out of the state house, that they go to court. Oftentimes there's some sort of at least temporary stay placed on them, so they can't go into effect until, for example, the court case plays out. We saw with House Bill 68, which was the ban on gender affirming care, and the Save Women's Sports Act, it was paused from going into effect, and the judge said, let's let this whole entire trial play out, and then it ultimately went into effect. Sometimes we see these laws do not go into effect at all, so it will be interesting to see how this one plays out in court.
Yeah. There are some questions about how it will be enforced, and I know this broke right before the Thanksgiving holiday, but have any schools or universities reacted yet?
Most of them are saying, you know, we're reviewing it, we plan to be in compliance, we are, committed to having a welcoming environment for all our students and staff. So nothing too solid yet.
Yeah, they kind of got to figure out what it means, how it's going to work. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, it doesn't ban schools from having single-use bathrooms.
I believe that is correct, right. Yes.
So they can
yes.
have single-use bathrooms, and adults of minor children can take them into the opposite-sex restroom.
Yes, that is correct. That would not impact the bill whatsoever at all.
Also, like janitors, people who need to go in for yeah. use, people assisting someone with a disability, those are the few exceptions in it.
Well, Governor Mike DeWine is also going to have to pay up. He and Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer had a friendly wager over Saturday's game. And unfortunately, Michigan prevailed 13-10, and so DeWine bet a candy basket, highlighting all of Ohio's local candy flavors, and he'll be sending it up to Gretchen for the fourth year in a row. And this is not the show to lament what happened on Saturday, but I just had to get that out.
I feel your pain, Anna.
Yeah. So the only other, I guess, I mean, I don't know. It is state dollars, but if Ryan Day were to be let go, there's no evidence of that as yet, they would have to pay him out. And the Columbus Dispatch had an article today about what it would cost by Day out of his contract. They would spend many, many millions of dollars to buy him out, but we'll have to wait and see. Anywho, one of the bills moving during lame duck is about religious release programs. These are private programs that take students out of public schools during lunch or recess for religious education. We recently did a whole show about them, but most of these outside groups are Christian-based, like LifeWise here in Central Ohio. But Megan, the Satanic Temple wants to take kids out of class in Marysville.
Yes, that's correct. So I think it was just a matter of time until something like this was going to happen, or a non-Christian affiliated organization was going to try to do something similar to what LifeWise is doing with the introduction of this bill. It still would have to pass. But yes, the Satanic Temple, they're not necessarily Satan worshippers, if I understand that correctly. They are just, they are opponents of conservative religious groups such as the folks like LifeWise, it sounds like. And so they say, hey, how about us? Like, why can't we do basically the exact same thing once a month, take students who have permission from their parents outside of school? And basically, it sounds like they want to teach students how to be good citizens and character growth. And so it sounds like not necessarily anything inherently.
Yeah, they call it their Hellian Academy of Independent Learning, or HAIL. And it seems to be a kind of a secular humanism kind of program.
And based on reporting in the Columbus Dispatch, it seems like lawmakers are not going to be swayed by something like this. It's certainly, I know Representative Gary Click told the Dispatch, you know, this is kind of just a smokescreen.
A publicity stunt.
Sure, because, I mean, when you think about it, what parents are going to send their students to the Temple of Satan? I'm sure there are some, maybe, but, that was kind of the lawmaker's perspective. But like Megan said, it was probably only a matter of time before a non-Christian group kind of tried to test the waters with a program like this.
And this, so some schools already do allow religious release time programs. This bill, if it's signed into law, literally only changes one word from may to shall, meaning all public schools in the state would have to have some sort of policy to allow religious release time. Doesn't necessarily mean you have to sign your student up for it, but every public school would have to have a program. They couldn't block it. They couldn't decide not to.
Yeah. And it's, of course, in response to some of these schools, especially in Central Ohio, kind of pushing back and getting rid of their religious release programs.
Yeah. Some of the concerns that they've cited is, you know, life, not that some of these religious release programs have perhaps a little too aggressively encouraged the students who attend to recruit others to attend, rewarding them with candy or ice cream parties, and it's led to some problematic bullying.
Yes, that's right. There was a parent of a student from the Defiance local schools up in Northwest Ohio who testified recently in the State House saying that his child is not in the LifeWise program and a second grader, I believe, and goes to an unsupervised study hall during that time and has received some harsh comments from students about why she is not going.
Yeah. But, you know, the proponents of the bill say that this is a school issue, right? If the children are behaving inappropriately, that should be handled. But I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. Do you guys have any sense on whether this requirement for religious release is going to get done in the next couple of weeks?
So I think it's interesting because this started off as a House bill and it was primarily being pushed in the House. But right before lame duck started at the start of November, the Senate introduced their own version of this bill. So companion bills typically mean, as we all know, that something is getting fast tracked or moving forward a bit quicker. So we'll have to see what House and Senate leadership thinks about it. I think House leadership wasn't as straightforward on their thoughts on it. So we'll see what happens. But
it's such a small change in the Ohio Revised Code. As Natalie said, it's literally changing one word. So it definitely feels like it would be something that's prime for getting shoved into a Christmas tree bill somewhere. Like maybe it doesn't pass on its own, but in the wee hours of the night, it's added to some broader education bill.
I could see that. Yeah.
Which we saw previously with the chicken bill in terms of fracking.
Yes. A bill about how many baby chickens you have to buy at one time became a bill about drilling for oil underneath our state parks. So one never knows.
It's that time of the year.
So if you're headed down to the State House tomorrow, Senator Kirk Schering will be lying in state inside the State House rotunda. Schering passed last month after a long battle with cancer. And, you know, this is not an honor that everyone gets. Like, you don't, like, not just anybody gets to lie in state in the rotunda.
Yeah, and we saw former Speaker of the Ohio House and the only female Speaker of the Ohio House in its history, Joanne Davidson. She was lying in state just a few weeks ago. So this is the second time in just a few weeks something like this is happening. But like you said, it's a big honor. When Kirk Schering passed away, Twitter, Facebook, everything was just flooded with positive remarks about him and things like that from his colleagues, friends. So it will probably be a pretty big showing. tomorrow.
Yeah. So his body lies in state at 10 a.m. And then the senators are holding a tribute in the chambers at 1. And then there'll be a memorial in the atrium at 2 p.m. Coming up, why Attorney General Dave Yost is back in court over abortion. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us is Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the State House News Bureau, Natalie Fahmy, State House reporter for NBC4, and Megan Henry, a reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Attorney General Dave Yost is going back to court on the abortion issue. He wants an appeals court to reverse a ruling that all portions of the heartbeat bill are unconstitutional. Natalie, can you walk us through the background of this case?
Sure. So, spans over a bit of time. So when Roe v. Wade was overturned, Ohio had a approximately six-week abortion ban that was enacted. It was only enacted for a couple of weeks before a court put it on hold. Flash forward to last November, November 2023, Ohioans put a reproductive rights amendment in the state's constitution. And then eventually, many months later, a Hamilton County judge in Cincinnati ruled that the heartbeat ban was unconstitutional. Attorney General Dave Yost is not arguing that the six-week portion is particularly the part that is unconstitutional, but he's saying other parts in that legislation should still hold up, and they're not necessarily spelled out in that reproductive rights amendment that was passed by voters.
Yeah, one of the things he wants is doctors to tell patients if they find a fetal heartbeat. So I don't know. We'll have to kind of see where this goes. Ultimately, I think, Sarah, we always knew this was going to the Ohio Supreme Court.
Absolutely. And I think that that was the argument that both sides of the Supreme Court races were making leading up to this most recent election, because, you know, abortion is not a settled issue in Ohio just because voters ratified 2023 issue one, fall 2023 issue one. These things are being litigated out. And of course, like Natalie said, Yost is saying, you know, I'm not arguing with like the core, this six-week ban is not allowed, but he's kind of chipping away around these other things and saying, well, what about this and what about this? And there are other lawsuits on other abortion laws proceeding as well. So,
yeah, it could take a while, though. Court cases do not move quickly through the process, so we'll have to wait and see. And while we're on the topic of the Attorney General and ballot initiatives, his office has given approval to a language of a petition to end qualified immunity. Megan, can you remind us what qualified immunity is?
I'm going to pass it off to one of my other colleagues.
Okay. I think I can pick it up. So public officials receive like a certain level of what's quote unquote qualified immunity. And you see this most often in cases with police officers. So if a police officer shoots and kills someone, their case is treated differently than a case if a civilian shoots and kills someone because they had to do it in the line of duty. That's the argument. It was part of their job, potentially. So they receive some level of protection for, you know,
civil lawsuits
related to sometimes, you know, you've seen some of these cases where maybe a grand jury hasn't brought criminal charges against a police officer, but then maybe the family will sue. So, I mean, that's kind of at its core. It's this argument over how many civil protections police officers should get in the line of duty. And, you know, Yost has kind of gone back and forth with this group just over the language and how it's presented. And so now it's finally moving forward.
Yeah, he said that a recent Ohio Supreme Court ruling changed his mind. That ruling wasn't about this petition, but it basically, Natalie, had to do with what kind of authority he has to monkey around with the wording of these.
Right. And, you know, the attorney general has said several times, whether we view it this way or not, that he, even if he's against something like the qualified immunity amendment, he looks towards the reproductive rights amendment, which he was also against, but approved their language. So he was like, eventually they'll lawyer up and they'll get the language right. So interesting to see that it's going through now. Of course, now the Ohio ballot board, they're meeting this week. They have to ensure that it's only one topic, and then they can start collecting signatures. They need nearly 500,000 to make it on the ballot in November. So still a ways to go until voters actually see this.
If they ever do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the thing. I think you've seen there's always been these statewide issues in Ohio, but you've seen a number of big ones on these kind of hot topics more recently. But it's really hard to make the ballot. I mean, you saw folks gathering signatures for the minimum wage amendment. That kind of fizzled out. They came up short in the end. They kept saying they were going to submit it, and then they never did. And for a group that has faced so many setbacks in the first step of the process, I definitely think it could be a heavy lift for them.
So not everything moving through the legislature is contentious this year. There is a bipartisan bill to modernize Ohio's adoption process. It passed the Senate last week in a unanimous vote. And Megan, not many things get unanimous votes.
That's right. Yeah, it does not happen often. So now the bill will go back to the House to concur on some changes that were made. But essentially, this bill would just basically modernize, as you were saying, modernize the some adoption laws here in Ohio. Oftentimes, lawyers will look through their revised code and see what needs updated or changed, which is what happened here. And so this bill is near and dear to the representatives who introduced it. Her representative, Ray, was adopted as a child, and Representative Baker has 3 adopted children of her own. So essentially, this would just, in addition to modernizing the bill, would also change some of the things such as foster to adopt and open that up. Make it more easier for kinship caregivers, as well as providing more financial support to pregnant mothers who are going to adopt their children. So we'll probably see that DeWine sign this bill into law here soon, it would seem.
Yeah. The Ohio House is scheduled to reconvene on Thursday, so we'll have to see whether they take it up then. Another thing being debated at the State House is public pensions this week. Lawmakers are moving on a bill to require local governments to pay more towards the retirement of their police and firefighters. Natalie, the Ohio Mayor's Alliance says, you know, getting these pension funds more solvent is great, but we cannot afford this bill, essentially.
Yeah, they say there are a lot of unintended consequences. First off, they say this is a massive unfunded mandate by the state. If it were to pass, we saw it pass committee 2 weeks ago now, I believe. The other thing that they argue was that if we have to contribute more to the police and fire pension fund, then we're not going to be able to put that money towards salaries of our first responders. And we have heard time and time again that recruitment is really, really difficult right now for law enforcement. So their main concern is that if we are taking some of our local government funds and putting it into these pensions, we're not going to have as many officers and firefighters on the streets actually serving the people.
And it's kind of a double-edged sword, because then the proponents argue that, like, you know, the Ohio Fraternal Order of Police argue that because there's a recruitment issue and because there are fewer officers, there's fewer money going into the pension fund because there's fewer officers to contribute to that pension fund. So pensions are such a tricky issue, and they've got so many layers to them. And so it kind of feels like a double-edged sword.
And this bill wouldn't increase the amount of money like a retiree is getting or anything like that. The whole idea is that it just makes the pension fund more solvent. I believe it would take the police fund particularly from about 19% to 24%. That's up to par with the current fire pension contributions. So it's just kind of leveling them out.
Yeah, and the thing to keep in mind about firefighters and police officers in particular is their retirements happen much earlier than other government employees. Like you don't often see a 65-year-old firefighter. It's just the physicality of the job is limiting. So, Sarah, Both GOP legislative leaders have said they want to pass a parents' bill of rights before the end of lame duck. What is a parents' bill of rights?
Sure. So this is a topic that's been debated at the State House before this legislative session. And it kind of harkens back to Florida's so-called Don't Say Gay bill. I mean, that's what the opponents call it. Of course, the proponents call it a parents' bill of rights. And it has to do with teachings about gender and sexuality in classes. It's kind of an over-encompassing bill, and I'm going to touch on Natalie because she's covered this one a lot too. But this bill's been debated since early 2023, this legislative session. It passed the House, and it's kind of been languishing in the Senate since. One of the things that it does is it notifies parents if in a classroom setting a teacher is going to be teaching about quote-unquote sexuality content. So that's obviously kind of a broad definition, and parents have the right to, you know, potentially pull their student from that teaching. It also has to do with if a student is, you know, seeing a change in their physical or mental health, counselors or other school professionals have to, under a certain level, notify parents. Now, there have been some changes made to the bill, most recently in June, when the Senate brought it more in line with the Florida law, because that law, which passed in 2022, has been undergoing litigation, and it's kind of ended in this settlement where they made some changes. One of those specifically, I believe, is that it used to be that even like smaller health changes, a school professional would have to notify a parent. Now it's quote-unquote major changes. So, you know, proponents argue that this bill brings more autonomy to parents to oversee what schooling looks like for their kids. You know, if something's going wrong at school, they're going to be notified about it. But opponents, particularly LGBTQ advocates, have said that it's kind of a, quote, forced outing bill. So if a kid, you know, tells a school counselor that they are of a certain sexuality, they are going to be outed to their parents. And school professionals, like social workers, have also argued it doesn't really give them the autonomy to do their jobs properly and to protect students who may be in situations of abuse.
Yeah, that was one of the questions I think that's come up a lot, Natalie, is what if the parent is the abuser?
Right. And, you know, I believe the bill has some language in it that's like required to tell the parent unless you believe student is in danger. But that's really hard. I mean,
that's
for example, vague. I went to a public school. I had 500 kids in my class, and there were like 32 kids in each class. So, you know, that's a lot of students to keep up with and know exactly what's happening at their home. Unless there's clear and direct signs of something like that, it is probably difficult for a teacher or a counselor to know that that student is in danger, potential abuse is happening, something like that. It'll be really interesting to see what happens. Like Sarah mentioned, both House and Senate GOP leaders say this is a priority bill and they want to see it passed. It was introduced last GA as well, and of course, ultimately did not end up passing. So we'll have to see if this is going to have to take a third another reintroduction before passing again.
Let's talk about pot. Passing a bill on Delta 8, which is what they call diet weed, it's sold at grocery gas stations, most likely across the state of Ohio, is a high priority for many lawmakers this lame duck session, but it's so far been tangled up in larger marijuana reforms that can't get through the House.
So,
Either or.
Go ahead. And they do have some standalone Delta 8 bills now. Some of them are a little more extreme than others. Like the current one in the Senate would ban the sale completely of these THC products. Some other ones just regulate them more, put some age restrictions on them. Probably going to end up somewhere in the middle on that. It is really interesting because Republicans and Democrats and senators and representatives agree they want to get something done. They just haven't been able to do it since DeWine first called on them to do it many, many months ago.
The governor has kind of been the town crier on this one, and I, like, feel bad saying that about our governor, but, I mean, he has been asking the legislature to do something about Delta 8 since literally December of last year, like begging them. I mean, we would be in unrelated press conferences and he'd be like, it's a great time to do something about Delta 8. And, you know, something that's really interesting that's emerged here is there's really heavy lobbying on both sides, gas stations and head shops. Like, you know, I was in a vape shop down the street from campus. I'm not going to say why, but I was in a vape shop and they had a list of every single phone number for every single state senator saying, call your senator and tell them to not vote for this ban. So you see these groups that really don't want to see a ban because they're making money off these products. The marijuana industry, like the licensed marijuana industry, they want a ban. Like, I mean, I think they would settle for something in the middle, but they're lobbying for the bill that bans it in the Senate because, you know, some of these dispensaries say, well, you know, we have to go through all this red tape to ensure that our products are safe. And, you know, we have to charge higher prices because of the taxes and the state is losing out on this tax revenue because they're not taxing these products that, you know, essentially have the same effect, but without the same licensing requirements. So it's definitely a heated argument. I think it's a big question of whether something gets done because, again, lawmakers have said it's a priority, but they have not been able to find common ground on this for a year. But I think, you know, the bill in the Senate, I've heard, has a lot of work has gone into it. It sounds like senators are open to moving back from a ban. And something to watch, of course, next session, too, is if Senate President Huffman, who just ran to be Speaker over in the House, which is a whole nother thing I won't get into on
this show.
Yeah, we've
talked about it a lot. But Speaker-elect Huffman.
Speaker-elect Huffman, he backed a bill really pulling back on some of the marijuana laws in the state.
Home grow.
So we could go into next GA, and even if we see some Delta 8 changes, we could still see some marijuana changes, too.
Yeah. Chris Lindsay, a policy director for the American Trade Association of Cannabis, actually told Sarah's outlet, the State House News Bureau, that Ohio is one of a handful of states with zero regulations on Delta 8.
I think that's the big
There's supposed to be a cut there. We're working a little bit. Oh, looks like it's ready.
I do think that the harms associated with the production and sale of unregulated synthetic THC is enough that we just need to stop these sales.
So, Sarah, as you were saying, it sounds like they just want it to stop. But, Megan, do you think we'd compromise on 21 and older?
I think there definitely will be compromises, whether it comes to regulation and age restriction, a little bit of both. But I think that's like the big thing. Recently at a committee meeting that it kind of kept coming back to regulations, like Sarah was mentioning. And too, I think there's a whole other side of this too that we saw the State House recently with testimony of healthcare professionals who are in favor of regulations because they've just seen, especially children's hospitals in the state have seen such an increase of incidents involving these intoxicating hemp products.
And I mean, I think the important thing to remind people, and we've obviously hinted at it, but not said, there are no regulations on these products.
Yes.
You can be 10 years old and you can go to a gas station and buy hemp that can get you high. And that is a pretty crazy thing when you think about it. I mean, I think a lot of people, no matter the party, no matter how they were elected, I definitely think a lot of people want to at least see those regulations. But you hear from the marijuana industry that they're saying, well, why is it just an age restriction when, again, we have to go through all this testing and these products are not going through that same testing? So there is a loud voice, I would say, at the State House of healthcare professionals and the marijuana industry who say it has to be more than just an age restriction.
And that's what we saw recently, or about a year ago, at a DeWine press conference where he said how they sent 15-year-olds to a gas station, I believe, and had played the audio.
Oh, he had the crazy pictures of the stuff.
Yes. And played the audio of them legally buying these products, but just to show how, with no age restrictions, anyone, like we've been saying, can buy these products.
Coming up, what incoming Senator Bernie Moreno has to say about when J.D. Vance will leave his seat. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us is Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Statehouse News Bureau, Natalie Fahmy, Statehouse reporter for NBC4, and Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Sarah, you talked to incoming U.S. Senator Bernie Moreno last week, and what did he have to say about when J.D. Vance might leave the Senate?
Sure. So he had a press availability in Columbus coming off of freshman orientation in D.C., which was kind of his first romp in D.C. It's, you know, when they pick the lottery for who gets what office and all of that
fun
stuff.
He figures out where the bathrooms are.
Yeah, it's kind of like
the cafeteria is.
It's a very quintessential. There are so many orientations in life, not just high school and college orientation. But he, you know, was asked about who Governor DeWine might appoint to the Senate in J.D. Vance's stead, because, of course, Vance got a big promotion in November, and he will be vice president starting January 20th. But under the Constitution, there's kind of this weird gap where Congress takes office in early January, like in the first couple of days of January, but the new president is not inaugurated until January 20th. And Moreno said that he thinks that Senator Vance should get to be the senior senator from Ohio before he takes the vice presidency, you know, basically alluding that it's very likely that Vance is not going to leave his Senate office because he doesn't have to resign until he's sworn in, as long as he's resigned by the time he's being sworn in as vice president. And it sounds like Vance may stick around in those early weeks of January to kind of help move committee hearings on some of Trump's cabinet appointees, because the Senate can't vote on cabinet appointees until after January 20th, but they can have some of these hearings once Congress takes office.
Moreno pretty much said, I expect, and I'm doing air quotes now, obviously no one can see them at home, but
they can up there.
He expects to serve his first couple weeks alongside Vice President-elect J.D. Vance.
And the process of picking a new senator is up to Governor Mike DeWine. There's not an immediate special election. That'll happen in 2026. But he is going to have to pick somebody. And from what I understand, Governor Mike DeWine's phone has been ringing nonstop with every county commissioner and random Republican who thinks they might want to be the next sitting senator.
Yeah, it's definitely been a robust application process to a hiring committee of one. And of course, it's not a hiring committee of one.
No.
Trump is, I'm sure, also weighing in on who he'd like to see as a Republican senator. But Moreno says the decision lies with DeWine at the end of the day. And DeWine told reporters back in July, when this scenario first came up, when he maybe was getting some calls, but not quite as many now that it's become a reality, that this is going to be the biggest decision that he makes before the end of his term as governor.
Arguably the end of his political career.
Absolutely. So,
No pressure.
I think some of the timing is going to be determined by when Vance resigns. So we may not have a name until January. I don't know if he'll announce it before Vance resigns, because he said some of it is going to be determined by when Vance submits his resignation.
Yeah, and DeWine is being pretty tight-lipped about who's on his short list. Of course, we see articles, and even we've reported, some of those possible names, some of the people that might be on the governor's short list. But
some have openly said they want it.
Yes, some have openly said they don't want it. But as far as criteria goes to the governor, he is being somewhat vague, just kind of like, I want someone who's not going to be primaried, which is interesting. Not sure if he's alluding towards not appointing some of the people who have run for Senate in primaries and lost in them. So he wants someone who's not going to be primaried, someone who's campaigned before, someone who has a name that's already kind of out there. So it will be interesting to see how that plays out.
And Republicans are making all these decisions with in mind there is a chance that Sherrod Brown runs in 2026 against whoever is appointed, because of course he just lost by 4 points, but Trump was on the ballot. And I think that's a big factor that Republicans have to calculate, because
in a midterm, midterms traditionally do not favor the party in power.
Absolutely. And Brown has been successful in years where popular Republicans were on the ballot, like DeWine himself.
Well, we will have to wait and see, but I'm pretty sure the race for the U.S. Senate seat will kick off early 2025.
It's just not fair. At the end of the day, as a reporter, we are going to be covering Senate race after Senate race.
Yeah.
I thought we were supposed to get like a bye year, but I guess not.
Well, look at it this way. If we have, we might have statewide issues like $15 on minimum wage in 2025, and then a Senate in 2026, and then a Senate in 2028, and then another Senate race in 2030, because we cannot get off this merry-go-round.
Nope. Not to mention the governor's race in 2026.
Yes. Never a dull moment. Megan, I want to talk about a ruling from the Ohio Supreme Court that you've been covering that says state law does not allow transgender individuals to correct the sex marker on their birth certificates. What's going on there?
Yes, I'm actually going to pass this off to one of my colleagues, see if Sarah Natalie.
I haven't covered that at all. I'll be candid, so I don't want to touch on something I haven't covered.
Okay, so here's what I know that's in my very clever notes, is they essentially have said it's up to the General Assembly, that the state could allow this, but the state would have to allow it. Other states, I used to work in Colorado, they passed a law allowing transgender people to change the sex marker on their birth certificates. This also allows it to change them on their driver's license and on other documentation. But I think it's safe to say that the Republican-controlled General Assembly will not be passing a law like this.
Especially given some of the legislation they've passed in relation to transgender students, Ohioans, minors, it seems pretty unlikely that they are going to be lenient in this area.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that, sure, the state house could do it, they won't do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like Natalie said, you've got these laws, and even though you know, some of these proponents of these bills argue that they're parental rights bills, or that they are bills that aren't necessarily legislating transgender people directly. You do have lawmakers who outwardly say that they do not believe that transgender people exist. So, I mean, it's not a friendly environment to transgender Ohioans at the state house. And I think that's a pretty objective statement.
All right, who knows about property taxes?
Oh, I know a whole bunch about property
okay,
taxes.
Okay, great. Natalie, so we have been talking probably for at least a year now since a large number of counties got their annual it's like every couple of years they do an increase. They reevaluate all the properties in the county. They decide what you're going to pay. And there's been a really big conversation about the fact that it's gone up a lot for a lot of folks.
That's right. So property taxes have gone up across the state. No matter who you are, you've probably seen an increase in your property tax bills. And it's important to note it doesn't only affect homeowners. Even if you're renting, whoever owns that property is probably seeing an increase and likely passing that off to the renter as well. So in a time where people otherwise can't afford to live and buy groceries and gas and things like that, this is just kind of the icing on the cake for a lot of people. So lawmakers have introduced nearly 24 bills at this point to try to remedy the issue. Several of them are bipartisan. Some of them have moved forward in significant ways, but a lot of them are pretty much stalled. So there was this property tax committee to study it and kind of come up with solutions that they
like
think,
we do when there's ever anything they can't agree on.
Right.
Let's study it.
So that they think will work better than the nearly 24 bills they've already introduced and have had several hearings on. That study was supposed to come out several months ago. I talked to one of the chairmen of that study commission just a couple of days ago, and he says the goal now is to get it out in December and to hopefully put some property tax provisions in the state budget. So as we know, the state budget probably won't pass until June, and then they will go into effect once several days after the governor signs it, about 90, depending on what kind of clause is in there. It could be sooner. So Ohioans likely aren't going to see any real property tax relief until middle of next year at best.
Yeah. They also had a housing committee too, which was looking at some of the similar issues, because the reason your property taxes are going up is because your home price is going up. And on the one hand, that's not a bad thing. If you own a home, you have equity in it, it's getting more valuable. But the flip side of that is if you're older, if you're on a fixed income, if your wages haven't been rising at the rate of your property taxes, there are real people who will have to sell their homes because they can't afford the property taxes anymore.
Exactly. So it's even people who've paid off their mortgage, for example, and like you said, are living on a fixed income. Now their property taxes are so high, they can't afford to live in the home that they've been living in for decades or that they paid off the mortgage on. So it's for some Ohioans, it's a really dire situation.
As someone who lives in a high property tax school district, I feel their pain.
And that's the other thing, too. Some lawmakers kind of blame the voters, and they say the onus is on the voters because they keep passing these levies and increasing their very own property taxes. Despite the assessments of their properties, they can take some of this into their own hands.
Just vote no, apparently, is what they're saying.
Pretty much.
Ohio State Senator Terry Johnson has brought up the neo-Nazis marching in Columbus when he just introduced a bill to define anti-Semitism under the Ohio law. His legislation incorporates a definition of anti-Semitism created by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance in state law to determine whether an individual has committed, quote, an ethnic crime. I find this interesting. I mean, those dozen neo-Nazis marching in Columbus have really made a lot of headlines.
They have. And I do think it's also timely when you look at the war in Gaza as well, because there have been, you know, claims of anti-Semitism against some of these pro-Palestine protesters, which, you know, very divisive issue, very tough issue. But I mean, you've heard a lot more about just rising anti-Semitism in the United States in the last year or so. So I definitely think it's timely in that regard beyond the neo-Nazis who were marching in Columbus just a week ago.
This also isn't the first time we've seen neo-Nazis in Columbus either. And I think another interesting piece of it is, you know, the response to them, I think somewhat expectedly, was not very warm. So I think that's another reason they're making so many headlines. I mean, they faced pretty immediate backlash from some of our residents here in the city.
And too, President Joe Biden called them out as well, the neo-Nazis. And going back to Sarah's point about the war over in Gaza, the representative, I believe, who introduced the bill in a sponsor testimony said that some of this is also due to some speech on campus that we saw in the wake of protests earlier this year. So that was also part of the genesis of the bill, I believe.
Yeah, and it's very late in the game to be introducing legislation, but, you know, never say never in lame duck, I think is safe to say.
Sure. It's a fine line, but too, between freedom of speech and freedom of expression and, you know, what constitutes hate and what doesn't.
Yeah. Final bill moving through the legislature, Megan, is about school vouchers and the private schools who take them. A Republican-backed bill requiring greater accountability for schools that take public dollars has really gotten a lot of changes. Can you tell us a little bit about it and whether we're actually going to see anything pass?
Yes, so this is kind of a complex bill. It's interesting because even though it would add transparency to the voucher program, it was introduced by Republicans. So this kind of shows that even though school choice proponents are typically Republicans, there is some disagreement on exactly how they want to look in Ohio. But yes, a lot of the teeth in the accountability part of this bill was recently taken out through a recent committee hearing. Basically, in it still, what there is a requirement that would require there to be a report card for these private schools who receive these vouchers as well. That's something that advocates have called for. But yeah, a lot of the language around, you know, where this money is being spent, where it's going towards, who is receiving these vouchers have all been stripped away from the bill, which could get voted out of committee possibly this week. So this could be a very interesting player in lame duck.
Especially as we approach spending $1 billion a year on student vouchers.
Absolutely. And Speaker-elect Huffman, Senate President Huffman, is a big supporter of universal vouchers.
Yeah, so we'll have to wait and see what happens there. But yeah, we have universal eligibility now. You know, any student who wants to go gets some amount of money. There is a financial cutoff. But Yeah, I think the idea of the report card seems pretty fundamental because it's kind of how people shop for schools. So, I don't know. As all things lame duck, I feel like a broken record. We'll have to wait and see.
I also think it'll be really interesting to see how active they really are, this lame duck. I mean, if Senate President Matt Huffman's like, well, current House Speaker Jason Stevens is going to block some of my bills, I may as well just throw my hands up and wait until next General Assembly when I'm the Speaker and someone I know who I work well with and agree on policies with is going to be the Senate President-elect Rob McCauley.
And listen, it's obviously not a done deal until January. Yes. So more inaction in the House over these next 2 weeks is just more reason to make his case in January.
That was Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio State House News Bureau. Thank you. And thanks to Natalie Fahmy, State House reporter for NBC4, and Megan Henry for the Ohio Capital Journal. And thank you all for listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News.